industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Dr. Tony Spadaro completed medical school at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and emergency medicine residency at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, and is currently a combined fellow in medical toxicology and addiction medicine at Rutgers New Jersey Medical School.
So my talk is Bitter Victory, Doping in the Early Olympic Marathons. I have no financial conflicts of interest to disclose, but I have used 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine to help with races before. So the modern Olympics were started in 1896 in Athens. The organizers planned to hold a 25-mile race with inspiration from the apocryphal story of Pheidippides running from the town of Marathon to Athens and then subsequently collapsing and dying. The games were intended for the best amateurs from around the world. Sporting culture was heavily influenced by elite British ideas, and excelling in sport was seen as a noble hobby of the educated aristocrat, whereas being paid for athletics was seen as proletarian, leading to vices such as gambling and cheating. The concept of ingesting something to unfairly gain an advantage had not been formulated yet, so early accounts of sports doping almost certainly would not have seen these activities through the same lens as we would today. But I do think they tell us something important about the spirit of sports and drug use in society in general, which takes us to the 1904 Olympic Games held in St. Louis, Missouri. This is our Olympic marathon field. The race reflected the amateurism of the time. Fred Flores was a bricklayer by day and would train at night. He was notable for getting in a car and being driven almost half the race, which led to his eventual disqualification. Felix Caravel was a Cuban runner. He did not bring any clothes to run in and had to cut off his trousers into shorts before the race. He experienced stomach cramps mid-race and then took a nap. Although some other notable runners were Len Tao of South Africa, who was chased off the course by a dog, and William Garcia of San Francisco, who, according to the official race report, inhaled so much dust that it caused an erosion of the membranous wall of his stomach and a serious hemorrhage resulted that nearly cost him his life. Our runner of interest for this story is Thomas Hicks at number 20. Of note, the race started at 3:03 p.m. on August 30th. Temperature in St. Louis was already in the low 90s, and this course was run on dirt roads with little shade and there was no water along the course. This is a photo of Thomas Hicks around mile 23. Around mile 17, he began to show positive signs of collapsing and was given something to aid him. He was considering dropping out later in the race until he found out that Fred Lores was disqualified for getting in the car. Then he realized he was in first place and that gave him a second wind. However, he needed to be given this aid a second time at mile 20. I obviously do not have any blood work from Thomas Hicks. However, to make this more case-like, I wanted to present some data gathered from marathon runners in general. So these are from a collection of a couple different studies of groups of runners as they finished a marathon. You can see that they have a fast heart rate, they have relatively normal electrolytes, some signs of strain to the kidney and to the heart. Runners in 1904 may have had more deranged physiology since they probably did not have the same hydration along the course or training beforehand. But hopefully this provides some context for what state Hicks might have been in before he took this doping agent. And you guys as toxicologists can speculate on the impact of what he took on this physiologic state. So what was it? It was strychnine. You can see here, Thomas Hicks took strychnine, one grain, which is probably around 1 milligram, mixed with egg white and brandy. You can see here a bottle of chocolate-covered strychnine, presumably to counter the bitter taste of strychnine. Did Hicks demonstrate strychnine toxicity? This is a description by a race official who wrote a report of the 1904 Olympics, who, by the way, knew that Hicks took this concoction. Over the last 2 miles of the road, Hicks was running mechanically. His arms appeared as weights, well tied down. He could scarcely lift his legs, while his knees were almost stiff. The brain was fairly normal. Race officials knew that he took strychnine, although it was not considered cheating. However, there was obviously some sense of what was fair, as Fred Lores was disqualified for being driven part of the race. Hicks finished with a time of 3 hours, 28 minutes, and 53 seconds, which is slower than most modern Olympic runners, but I think still respectable given the circumstances. We reconvened 4 years later in the 1908 Olympics held in London. Although this race was originally planned for a 24.8 mile or 40 kilometer course, the course start was moved closer to Windsor Castle. The reason for this is debated, either for security at the start line or so that the royal family could see the start. And the finish was slightly altered so that as runners enter the track in a stadium, they would run a 3/4 of a lap counterclockwise instead of 1/4 of a lap clockwise, so the spectators could see more of the finish. And that is how the race became the 26.2 mile or 42.19 kilometer race we know today. The race started around 2:30 p.m. when the temperature was 82 degrees Fahrenheit. This is Dorando Pietri. He was a 23-year-old Italian man. He worked in a confectionery store prior to serving in the military for a short time. He was a crowd favorite by many accounts after some previous wins in Italian races. He used strychnine mixed with wine or champagne around mile 16 of the race, and you can see him holding a cork from the bottle in his hand as he crosses the finish line here. Here we have a video of Durandos entering the stadium, and you may wonder if he shows signs of strychnine toxicity. You can see him stumbling across here. At one point, he collapses and is needed assistance getting up. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was at the finish line of the race and described it as such: the little red legs going incoherently, but drumming hard, driven by a supreme will within. There is a groan as he falls once more, and a cheer as he staggers again to his feet. It is horrible yet fascinating, the struggle between a set purpose and an utterly exhausted frame. He finished with a time of 2 hours, 54 minutes, and 56 seconds, although it took him 10 minutes to complete the last quarter mile. Durando was ultimately disqualified, not for the use of performance-enhancing drugs, but because he had assistance in getting up after he fell, and the gold went to American John Hayes. Many felt that this outcome was unfair, although in future iterations of the Olympics, receiving external help, whether in the form of a drug or someone picking you off the ground, would be considered unfair. Drug use in sport wasn't officially banned in the Olympics until 1928, though even then there was little testing or regulations to enforce it. It may come across as surprising that what we consider now to be a deadly poison was used as a performance-enhancing drug. Strychnine comes from the Strychnos nux vomicus tree. It was used in Arab, Chinese, and Indian medicine to treat various things, including snake bites and abscesses. References to the nux vomicus began appearing in European texts in Sicily in the 1100s. In Latin, vomicus translates more closely to a wound or abscess. Later, this would be incorrectly translated to mean vomiting nut and would later be used as an emetic, although it was not a very effective emetic. There was a lot of interest in medicinal plants in Europe in the 1800s, and strychnine was used to treat all sorts of medical conditions, including deafness, intestinal worms, prolapse rectum, and lead poisoning. But its medical use really took off as a stimulant or analeptic. Before we discovered supportive care and letting patients metabolize the drug they overdosed on, we tried to wake them up. Here we see a case report that describes its use after an overdose of Verona, which is a barbiturate. Here, the treating physician gives strychnine, seemingly in response to cyanosis on day two of illness and in response to a feeble pulse on day three of illness. By day four, the patient has returned to baseline, thankfully. Strychnine was used in a number of nerve tonics meant to treat a number of ailments, in particular fatigue. Easton syrup contains iron, quinine, and strychnine with instructions to take 3 times a day and was generally advertised to improve mood and energy. How does strychnine work? Briefly, strychnine is a competitive antagonist of glycine at ligand-gated chloride channels. Normally, glycine binds this channel, chloride moves inward, and the cell becomes hyperpolarized and less excitable. This is important in muscle relaxation. Strychnine blocks the effect of glycine, making patients' muscles contract and unable to relax. It can cause facial trismus or lockjaw and opsitonus, which is arching of the back, which you can see in this picture in the bottom left. Clinically, this may appear as awake seizures as the muscles involuntarily contract, but the patient is alert and oriented. Eventually, the patient is unable to control the diaphragmatic muscles and they die a respiratory death. Tetanus can cause a similar clinical picture and effect, although through a different mechanism by blocking glycine release. You can imagine that these effects may be harmful in the marathon runner as they are breathing hard with high levels of lactic acid in their blood. The toxic effects of strychnine were also pretty quickly recognized, and it soon became a poison used in homicides and attained notoriety in Agatha Christie novels. It was also used to control populations of small mammals, including stray dogs, in big cities. And for a while, the strychnine nut was also called the dog nut. Today, it is still used as a gopher poison, and this might be an area where we as toxicologists might see it. But does it help with performance? To understand this experiment, we need to understand the ergograph, which is the contraption on the top. A muscle contraction will move the weight and cause a tracing that you see on the bottom here. You can see on the bottom in tracing A, there's a decrement in strength with each subsequent muscle contraction. Whereas in figure B, there's pretty similar muscle contraction throughout and then an abrupt drop off as the end as the person presumably becomes fatigued. Early experiments seem to show some benefit with the use of strychnine. On the left, the solid lines represent the control, and the dotted lines represent patients that got strychnine. They did two different time points, which is why there are a couple different experiments here. The height and number of contractions are higher in the dotted lines, indicating that the strychnine patients were able to do more muscular work in the first part of the experiment. Although you can see eventually that the solid line crosses over the dotted line, indicating that there is probably some eventual detrimental effect of strychnine on muscle contraction. On the right, you see ergographs from this experiment with six different patients. The top, the control, and the bottom shows the effect of strychnine. Unfortunately, they don't line up the cases exactly correctly, but you can see, for instance, for case six, that the ergograph is longer, indicating that they were able to sustain muscle contractions longer than the patient six in the control. Similarly, for five, four, and three, the ergographs of the strychnine patient are longer than the three, four, five, and six on the top. One and two look like the control patients performed a little better. This study did not exactly have a lot of statistics in it, but the authors concluded that this at least had some beneficial effect in muscular work, although seemingly it would probably help weightlifters more than marathon runners who need to sustain work for a long period of time. The use of strychnine in sport was relatively short-lived. While cocaine, tobacco, and alcohol were all used in the early part of the 20th century, sports doping really took off once amphetamines became widely available. Amphetamines were used by militaries on both sides during World War II to combat fatigue in soldiers. Pervitin was methamphetamine that was widely used in Nazi Germany. This bled into sports, but they were not without their side effects. On the top left here, we have Knud Ermark Jensen, who was a Danish cyclist. He competed in the 1960 Summer Olympics in Rome. On the day of the cycling event, it was 40 degrees Celsius, and he died of a heat stroke. Amphetamines were considered to have been contributory to his death, and there was an increased crackdown on amphetamines in sports. Steroids were also widely used in the post-war era. American scientist Paul DeKalb popularized testosterone as a way to improve all aspects of life, and you can see here from the cover page of his book that the male hormone discloses magic far beyond the merely sexual. It boosts muscle power, banishes mental fatigue, it causes heart pain. Steroids are one of many things used to dope today, and there is a constant cat and mouse game of new drugs and detecting their use. The use of strychnine is potentially not over. In 2016, Izzat Erkov of Kyrgyzstan was stripped of the bronze medal in weightlifting after he tested positive for strychnine, and it remains on the list of banned substances today. There have been various anti-doping agencies since the 1920s, but since 1999, the World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, is probably the most important standard for what is allowed or not in sport. In general, substances are banned if they meet two of three of these criteria: use of the drug improves performance, use of the drug is harmful to the athlete's health, and use of the drug violates the spirit of the sport. So while caffeine improves performance, its use is generally safe, and we have arbitrarily decided that it does not violate the spirit of the sport. Cannabis, on the other hand, is banned for use in competition, presumably because it is against the spirit of the sport, and maybe it's harmful to athletes' health, but I'm not sure if it enhances performance or not. Sports doping takes on many forms, and it can be sport-specific, such as the use of beta blockers to slow heart rate in archers, the use of drugs like trimetazine as an anti-anginal that is reported to improve non-glucose dependent energy utilization. Athletes try to increase their oxygen carrying capacity and hemoglobin counts with EPO, or because EPO is so heavily tested that some athletes have begun intentionally exposing themselves to carbon monoxide to naturally cause erythrocytosis and increase their blood cell counts. Common medications like tramadol get repurposed as performance-enhancing drugs, and there are new frontiers of doping all the time, and WADA has already began to put out regulations around gene editing. So our relationship to what is and isn't allowed in sport is ever evolving. We have carbon fiber plated shoes and carbon fiber bikes that make energy transfer much more efficient and make it nearly impossible to compare today's athletes to those of the past. With increased testing of testosterone levels, we are finding more athletes whose testosterone levels fall outside of a population mean. And whether or not we allow these athletes to compete in sport reflects probably more on our societal views about gender than it does reflect any sense of fairness in sport. As stories come out about international doping scandals, where whole teams potentially dope, it's not just about individual ego, but the pressures we have collectively to perform and which drugs we find acceptable to do so. So while we want our sports to reflect our noble aspirations for fairness that we strive for in society, from Thomas Hicks and Durando Pietri to today, the reality has been much more complicated. Thank you. These are my references.